I chose a snowboard. Our go-to spot was Snow Basin, my personal favorite among Utah's impressive array of ski resorts. It was about an hour's drive from our home, close enough for day trips, but far enough to feel like an escape. We'd pile into the car early in the morning, the excitement building as we wound our way up the mountain roads. These weren't regular winter vacations with cozy chalets and crackling fireplaces. Our trips were more of the rise and shine, hit the slopes, and be home for dinner variety. But there was something special about those day trips, a sense of adventure and freedom that was often missing from our heavily structured lives. I remember the first time I strapped on my snowboard at the top of a real run. The world looked different from up there, vast, white, and full of possibility. As I wobbled my way down the slope, falling more times than I care to admit, I felt a rush of independence. Yes, I spent more time horizontal than vertical. Chad and Kevin would zoom past me, showering me with snow and unhelpful advice like, just stand up, as if I was choosing to be an upside-down turtle. But I didn't care. This was something I had chosen for myself, different from what the rest of my family was doing. I decided I wanted to make a video inspired by that feeling for my channel. It was called Sherry Competes in the Olympics, a skit about being in the Olympics and snowboarding in the backyard. I had so much fun making it. There was a little bit of snow on the ground, but you could still see the grass, less winter wonderland and more sad, melting snowman's last stand. Kevin helped me with it, and the video starts with me asking him, "Hey, can we go snowboarding today?" Kevin replies, "Oh, I don't think so." Then I say, "Well, I have an idea." It shows me putting on all my snowboarding gear and going outside, where we see my hand-built recreation of an Olympic obstacle course, with a half pipe made out of some drainage pipe I found. I jumped on it with my snowboard, crushing the whole thing to pieces. Take that, structural integrity. I also jumped on the trampoline on my snowboard, with hilarious results. Picture a cat on a pogo stick, but with more flailing. By the end, I had more bruises than a dropped bag of plums, but hey, that's showbiz. I had a blast editing the video, adding a fake banner across the bottom that read, "Sherry Frankie from Utah, never competed before." At the very end, I photoshopped a gold medal on my chest. It was cringy and poorly filmed, the kind of video that makes film school professors wake up in a cold sweat, and it didn't perform very well in terms of views, but I didn't care. I loved just being goofy, being me. The video was my magnum opus, my Citizen Kane. I'd gotten pretty good at vlogging by this point. I'd watched a lot of YouTube tutorials, transforming myself into a regular Spielberg of the suburban wilderness. My weapon of choice? A Canon G7X camera, the holy grail among vloggers at the time. For shoots, I'd either set it up on a tripod or hold it myself, depending on whether I wanted my video to look professional or like it was filmed during an earthquake. For more formal Q&A videos where I'd sit on a couch, I had a ring light, but I didn't really know how to use it. The Q&As covered topics like school routines and random questions about my life. My channel was pretty wholesome, all in all. Like a Disney Channel show, but with worse lighting and more awkward pauses. And my subscriber count was ticking up and up, so I guess people were enjoying the videos, even the silly ones. On the morning of my 15th birthday, Ruby presented me with a new tripod, the perfect gift for a content creator. Of course, she filmed the whole present unwrapping session. With 8 passengers now nearing 2 million subscribers, no milestone, no private moment was left unmined for content. "Wow, Mom, this is amazing," I replied, genuine gratitude mixing with a familiar sense of performance. "Thank you so much." "You're welcome," Ruby beamed before turning to address the camera. "Now why would Sherry need new equipment?" "Because I have a channel," I blurted, the words rushing out. "I started one a while ago, and I wanted to grow organically, but then we decided not to talk about it." Ruby's smile remained fixed. "Yes, she is almost at 100,000 subscribers, so give her some love. She did this on her own. I did not shout her out once on Instagram or on my channel." "Does this mean I can leak to 8 passengers in my bio?" I asked, feeling like Oliver Twist asking for more gruel. "Yes," Ruby exclaimed. "Happy birthday, Sherry." And just like that, my wish came true. I knew the shout-out would bring a flood of new subscribers, and linking to 8 passengers would undoubtedly bring a tidal wave of traffic to my channel. It felt like a milestone of my own, getting that validation from my mom, even though it cemented my public persona as Ruby's mini-me rather than my own person. When Ruby posted the video, my numbers got the expected boost, translating to a few thousand dollars per month. In teenager currency, that's like a million frappuccinos. Alas, I couldn't touch any of it yet. Mom had set up the account in her name since I was still a minor. By the way, she said casually one day, months after I'd started earning, I'm taking 10% off the top for management fees. I nodded, not fully grasping the mom tax concept. What do you mean? You really think you would have ever started a YouTube channel, let alone a successful one, without my help? You owe me, Sherry. Business is business. I felt a knot form in my stomach. On one hand, Mom had a point. Her influence had undeniably boosted my channel. On the other hand, this felt like she was cashing in on my hard work. But as usual, what could I do about it? Nothing. Journal. I talked with my teacher, Mr. Heyman, today. I asked how I could better my relationship with my parents. He knows I can't have deep conversations with them. He said eventually I'll have to tell my mom I want a better relationship. He was kind and understanding and really listened to what I had to say. Now I'm jealous of Mr. Heyman's kids because I wish I could have a parent like him. One day after class, I found myself lingering in Mr. Heyman's classroom. Something about his patient demeanor made me feel safe. Before I knew it, words were spilling from my lips, a torrent of pent-up pain and frustration about life with Ruby, how cold and mean she could be, how the reality differed so greatly from what the world could see. I had never been this honest with anyone about my feelings regarding my mother, not even my old therapist. As I spoke, I watched Mr. Heyman's expression shift from polite interest to surprise, then to deep concern. Sherry, Mr. Heyman said softly when I paused for breath, I had no idea. This must be incredibly difficult for you. Those simple words, that acknowledgement, felt like a key unlocking something inside me. Mr. Heyman listened patiently as I poured out my heart, nodding encouragingly, his brow furrowed with empathy. He didn't try to offer quick solutions or dismiss my feelings. He just listened. As I left his classroom that day, I felt lighter than I had in a long time. The world hadn't changed. I would still go home to the same challenges, the same carefully choreographed family life. But something in me had shifted. I had an ally now, a trusted adult who knew the truth about Ruby, and who saw me, the real me, not the version that was too shut down to share her feelings. Chad, on the other hand, was becoming more isolated than ever, his clownish behavior and defiance being met with a harsh response at school. The rules were quite strict, and he was struggling to stay within the boundaries. It was interesting, the differences between us. While I tended to keep everything bottled up inside, Chad was more like a shaken-up bottle of Mentos and Coke, incapable of restraint. He was like a force of nature, constantly pushing boundaries and testing limits. One day in class, probably bored out of his mind, Chad decided it'd be hilarious to chuck a piece of candy corn at his buddy across the room. Classic Chad move. Except his aim was about as good as his judgment. The candy corn pulled a curveball and smacked the teacher instead. Boom. First infraction. After three infractions, a student would face suspension and then expulsion. In this zero-tolerance minefield, Chad was playing hopscotch with landmines. It only took a few more missteps, each as boneheaded as the last, before Chad found himself on the wrong side of the school's gates, expulsion papers in hand. My parents' faces when they got the news, I'll never forget it. A mixture of fury, disappointment, and bone-deep weariness that made them look like they'd aged a decade overnight. But the saga wasn't over. In August 2018, Chad almost ruined our biggest family vacation slash brand collab, a meticulously planned road trip to Universal Studios Hollywood in our biggest brand collaboration to date. Our itinerary was planned with military precision, each camera-worthy moment scheduled down to the millisecond. I vividly remember being in our van when Ruby said she had a plan. We're going to make a big mess so that we can show how well Wet Ones works. We made it gross. Gummy bears smeared on the windows, slime everywhere, chocolate all over everyone's faces, all to demonstrate the effectiveness of Wet Ones. It was all going so well, until Chad brought the chaos. The park had opened early just for us, which was a big deal, so we could get footage walking through the empty park. But while Ruby was filming her brand deal talking points in front of the iconic globe, Chad was being, in her words, an absolute punk, making constipated gargoyle faces and photobombing her carefully orchestrated brand content. Ruby's dream of picture-perfect family content was rapidly devolving into a blooper reel, so she banished him to the hotel room while the rest of us enjoyed the theme park. Chad, ever the rebel, wasn't about to let Ruby's parental decree keep him down. He snuck out of the hotel room, took a taxi, somehow sweet-talked his way back into Universal Studios, and had a great time by himself. When we got back to the hotel, he was gone. We had no idea where he was for a while. And that, as far as my parents were concerned, was the absolute final straw. In Ruby's and Kevin's eyes, Chad was becoming some kind of juvenile delinquent, a malfunctioning robot, and they just needed to find some way to reprogram him. They had already considered sending Chad to West Point Military Academy and had been dragging Chad from one therapist to another, desperate for a diagnosis, some official-sounding label to slap on his misdeeds. Much to their disappointment, most of these professionals said that at 14, Chad was too young for them to conclusively pathologize. Not to mention, he usually ran circles around those poor counselors. Chad was often the most manipulative person in the room. Turns out, growing up on camera is excellent training for pulling the wool over people's eyes. Looking back, my parents probably should have just given Chad the space and time he needed to grow up. Teenagers act out is practically in the job description. But no, Ruby and Kevin couldn't fathom such a simple solution. Instead, they doubled down, more determined than ever to find a Chad whisperer, someone aggressive enough to break through his defenses. They were on a mission to find the perfect person to crack his code and rewire him to their liking, which is how the monster came into our lives. A monster masquerading as a mental health professional, armed with a tight smile and a mind full of psychological warfare tactics. A monster who would see my mother's inner darkness and cultivate it, nurture it, until it eclipsed all light. A monster named Jody Hildebrandt. Part 3. The Conjurer. Chapter 16. Snake in the Garden. It was during that Orlando trip that Ruby, at her wit's end, sought advice from a family friend on what to do. The friend perked up. "Oh, I know just the person," she chirped, explaining that she had been attending workshops in Jody Hildebrandt's life coaching program, Connections. "Jody really seems to command a lot of respect," said the friend. "Maybe she'd be a good therapist for Chad, given his spirited nature." "Jody Hildebrandt," Ruby repeated, testing the name on her tongue. It sounded official, important. Like someone who could wrangle a herd of wild teenagers with just a stern glance. A licensed clinical mental health counselor, Jody had built a reputation in Utah's LDS community as something of a miracle worker. Her Connections program promised to help people overcome everything from porn addiction to distorted thinking, and she preached a philosophy based on three core principles: impeccable honesty, rigorous personal responsibility, and vulnerable humility. Intrigued by the idea of turning Chad from Dennis the Menace into an LDS poster child, Ruby immediately set up a Zoom call for Chad and Jody. This high-stakes video conference took place in our hotel room in Orlando, where Chad had been grounded for the remainder of the trip. After the initial call, Jody reported back to Ruby, expressing confidence in her ability to make progress with Chad if my parents committed to weekly one-on-one calls between him and Jody. Oh, and she had some other ideas for his immediate rehabilitation, including sending him away to Anasazi, a wilderness therapy program in Arizona for troubled teens. Jody painted Anasazi as a transformative experience, a place where Chad could shed his rebellious ways and emerge as the obedient, spiritually aligned son my parents craved. It sounded like a miracle cure-all, promising to fix every conceivable teenage problem with a bit of fresh air and wilderness survival skills. Never mind the eye-watering price tag of $13,945 for just 49 days of treatment. But my parents, flush with YouTube money and blinded by desperation, didn't even blink at the cost. They were too entranced by Jody's promises and too eager for a quick fix to question whether this was really in Chad's best interests. "Whatever you say," said Ruby, desperate for a solution, and thrilled to be collaborating in Project Chad with this supposed guru of self-help. I looked up Jody online, and something about her rhetoric made me feel uneasy. Even her photo was off-putting, her gaze sharp and efficient. Her smile seemed severe, unyielding. In retrospect, though, it wasn't just her physical appearance that unsettled me. It was the complete absence of any nurturing energy, the warm, comforting aura one might normally expect from someone who has supposedly dedicated their life to helping others heal. Instead, in her messaging and her appearance, she seemed oddly smug. Later, I dig deeper into Jody's backstory, much of which she herself had shared openly in various media, although it's hard to believe anything she says. She says she was the sixth of seven kids, born to a fighter pilot dad and a stay-at-home mom. The family motto was, "You are Hildebrand, go hard or go home." According to Jody, her mom lost a baby boy and was emotionally distant and didn't spend much time with her. Jody said her dad, while also emotionally closed off, taught her to work hard and not trust people. Growing up in the desert, Jody said she found she was more comfortable around animals than humans, milking the family goats and enjoying her time alone. Having grown up with very little affection, she admitted finding the sight of tenderness between parents and children disturbing. Jody has publicly shared stories of being sexually abused by a 15-year-old neighbor when she was 2 to 5, and again by a 16-year-old who lived with them when she was 7 to 9. She said that at age 21, she finally told a counselor about the abuse. In 1999, when she was 26, Jody's ex-husband filed for divorce. Jody got full custody of her children, who were 9 and 7 at the time, and in her books, she admitted finding it hard, managing her energetic young kids. She started her journey as a healer in 2003, becoming licensed as a clinical mental health counselor under the Utah Division of Professional Licensing in July 2005. Guided by heavenly instruction and inspired invitations, she devised her specialized coaching program meant to foster the thing she never had growing up, connection. Hence, connections. What troubled me most was how quickly my mother seemed willing to entrust Chad's fate to this virtual stranger, ready to ship him off to wilderness camp based on Jody's advice alone. I couldn't shake the feeling that we might be trading one set of problems for another. The day Chad left for Anasazi was rainy, the sky a heavy gray blanket that matched the weight in my chest. I watched as he stuffed a trash bag with clothes, his shoulders slumped. He caught my eye, and for a second I saw a flash of the old Chad, that mischievous sparkle, that huge grin. Then he was gone, swallowed by the gloomy morning. True to form, Ruby and Kevin couldn't resist recording a video to explain their decision. They painted Chad as some kind of juvenile delinquent in desperate need of an attitude overhaul. Kevin, uncharacteristically, took the lead, his voice stern as he laid out the situation. I could almost see Ruby's puppet strings controlling his words. Then Ruby took center stage. "Chad needs to develop some very basic maturity and skills," she declared. "This is a chance for a reset, a fresh beginning. The idea with wilderness therapy is if you can survive with these peers in the wilderness with nothing more than the clothes on your back and a couple of field supplies, then there's nothing in this world that you can't tackle." Ruby's excitement bordered on the manic. "It's like the real wilderness out there," she enthused, eyes gleaming. "There are snakes, bears, coyotes, cougars. It's the real deal. We want Chad to have some of those experiences. I think close encounters would be good for him, because those types of experiences can teach you what's really important. And he'll come home and he'll be like, 'Dude, I survived and there were bears. I can do anything.'" Beneath her forced levity, the underlying message was clear. This was another punishment, a way to break Chad down and rebuild him into their idea of a perfect, obedient son. "No one can fix anybody," Ruby continued, oblivious to the irony. "A person must choose if they're going to make changes in their lives. And so I think this experience will reveal Chad and everyone else who's out there to themselves, and they can learn to better themselves. Or just stay in the mud." As Ruby spouted this nonsense, I watched Kevin, nodding along at all the right moments. But there was something in his eyes. A flicker of doubt, perhaps? He'd later claim he disagreed at the time, before eventually falling in line. In that moment, though, he was the perfect, supportive husband, backing up his wife's delusions. Those days after Chad left were a blur of confusion and frustration. Ruby, in her infinite wisdom, decided we needed daily challenges to keep us connected while he was off playing Boy Scout Extreme. I remember rolling my eyes at most of them, but one in particular stands out in my memory. We were supposed to look into our own eyes and write about our light, whatever that meant, and how to make it grow. I went along with it, if only to avoid an argument. After all, arguing would probably lead to me being sent to the desert too, and I sunburn easily. I remember standing in front of the bathroom mirror, trying to do this ridiculous exercise. But instead of seeing any inner light or whatever, all I could focus on were my imperfections. It was like a dermatologist's nightmare come to life. My skin was dry and flaking like I was some sort of human croissant. There was a stubborn zit on my chin trying to form its own sovereign nation, and that one thick hair by my mole that seemed to grow back overnight no matter how many times I plucked it. I missed my brother so much. How these stupid daily tasks were supposed to somehow make up for his absence, I had no idea. Everything felt off balance, like we were a clown car with one less clown. And staring at my oily T-zone in the mirror was hardly going to make it feel any better. When Chad returned from Anasazi 3 months later, he talked about his time in the wilderness like it was no big deal, as if he just popped out for a quick nature walk rather than being exiled to the desert for a quarter of a year. He said it was fun in the end, being in nature with a bunch of kids. More freedom than he had at home. No vlogging responsibilities, building fires, seeing snakes, sleeping under the stars. But my parents weren't done with Chad yet, not by a long shot. Oh no, they'd already decided to hire Jody, at great expense, to embark on a series of one-on-one therapy sessions for Chad. This to me was concerning, perhaps even more so than camp, especially because the more I Googled Jody Hildebrandt, the more concerned I became. It was like falling down a rabbit hole lined with red flags. For instance, in 2012, a young man moved to Utah with his new wife and baby to attend Brigham Young University. His bishop recommended he see Jody for therapy. This turned out to be a terrible mistake. Without any proof, Jody accused her client of being an abuser and violated patient confidentiality by reporting him to BYU's Honor Code office as a sexual predator. She also reported him to the church. The fallout was brutal. The man was kicked out of BYU and the church. His marriage fell apart, the very thing he'd gone to Jody for help with. Jody's therapist license was suspended in 2012 as a result. But for her client, the damage was already done. And here she was, still practicing, still wielding influence. It was as if she'd viewed her suspension as a sabbatical, used it to double down on her questionable methods. Feeling like we were boarding a train headed straight for Crazy Town, I pulled Chad aside for a sister-brother talk. We sat together in the basement, and I let it all spill out. "Jody's not cool," I said bluntly. "Like, she's bonkers. You should see the stuff online. She's practically a con artist." Chad shrugged, annoyingly unperturbed, like I just told him we were out of milk. "Chill, Sherry. I can handle her. She's just like all the others. All you have to do is agree with what they say." "No, I think this is a big mistake." Chad raised an eyebrow. "Sherry, she's just some middle-aged lady. If I don't do therapy with her, Mom's going to make my life even worse than it already is. Just be careful, okay? They say she tears families apart. Don't let her get in your head." "I won't. Listen, I survived the desert. I can survive Jody Hildebrandt." Chad thanked me for my concern. Then, in typical baby brother fashion, he went straight to Ruby and told her what I had said. A few days later, Ruby pulled me aside, fire in her eyes. "How dare you sabotage your brother's progress," she hissed. "He's getting help. And honestly, Sherry, you could probably use some help, too." I stared at her, shaking my head. "I don't need help from Jody." "Yes, you do. You don't like Jody. Anyone who doesn't like Jody is hiding something. It means you're threatened by the truth she speaks." Ruby nodded sagely, as if she just imparted the wisdom of the ages. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. "But Mom, she had her license suspended. Her own kids don't speak to her." "Her kids couldn't handle the truth. She's been called by God to help people." Ruby's eyes gleamed with the fervor of a true believer. She was sold on Jody, hook, line, and sinker. Chapter 17, The Cult of Connections. My first car was a hand-me-down from Kevin, a 2016 Ford Focus in pristine white. Every morning as I slid into the driver's seat to head to school, I felt a small thrill of freedom. With the radio humming softly and the world rushing by outside the windows, I could breathe, think, and just be myself without any prying eyes or expectations. It represented the first real taste of adulthood, of making my own decisions and charting my own course. Sure, that course was mainly between home and school, with the occasional rebellious detour to the drive-thru, but still, freedom. Like many aspects of my life, this newfound freedom came with a caveat. The car's title remained in Kevin's name, a detail that nagged at the back of my mind. In those quiet moments behind the wheel, I couldn't help but wonder, can Ruby swoop in one day and take this small piece of independence away from me? The lack of legal proof that the car was truly mine was always a source of anxiety, a reminder that my autonomy was still very tenuous and hinged on Ruby's unpredictable moods, which were about as stable as a Jenga tower in an earthquake. There had certainly been some strange shifts in her behavior now that she was so obsessed with connections. One day, Ruby and Kevin went to a connections conference, and when Kevin came back, he seemed stressed. He wasn't sure he liked the community, and would later say he felt like he was surrounded by a bunch of man-hating women. Still, a lot of people who he respected were part of connections at this point, so he ignored his doubts. Besides, Ruby seemed so enraptured by Jody and her philosophy, he dared not burst her balloon. It was easier to go along with it than to risk becoming the next target of Jody's truth-seeking missiles. But that was the beginning of the end for them. Ruby became more and more involved with connections, diving into Jody's concepts of truth and distortion, two innocuous-sounding words that would soon become the bane of my existence. The program was as expensive as it was extensive. The 6-week team leadership training, which included 6 90-minute sessions with a certified connections trainer and access to Jody's ever-growing library of more than 100 podcasts, came with a hefty price tag of $4,995 per person. For those truly committed to Jody's philosophy, or perhaps those she deemed in need of more intensive help, there was the 18-week company leadership training, costing $14,985. It seemed Jody believed in the old adage, if you're going to fleece someone, might as well go for the whole sheep. The fruits of her labor were evident in her $5 million luxury home in Ivins, a picturesque town 4 hours south. Complete with a pool and a safe room, it stood as a gleaming testament to how lucrative the business of fixing people could be, and just how persuasive Jody was at reeling in disciples and indoctrinating them. Jody's playbook focused on isolation and control. To fully embrace her teachings, connection students were urged to distance themselves from anyone not living by Jody's truth. It was like watching a real-life invasion of the body snatchers, observing my parents' sanity circle the drain as they morphed into Jody's devoted disciples. At first, I hesitated to use the word cult. It seemed extreme, but as I delved into some casual online research, nothing says normal teenager quite like Googling, is my family in a cult? Connections ticked all the boxes. Sure, we weren't being physically relocated to some remote compound a la Jonestown, but we didn't need to be. Our dedicated enclave within Utah was the perfect setup for someone like Jody, a ready-made, isolated community ripe for manipulation. Jody's followers were compelled to confess their distortions in group sessions and through constant phone calls with each other. Her little army, informing on each other, recruiting anybody who'd listen. The key to connection, paradoxically, was disconnection, isolating yourself from anyone who didn't speak Jody's language, making yourself totally dependent on your new connections family who would police your every thought until you existed in a hive mind of groupthink. At the heart of it all was Jody, running the show with an iron fist. To those outside her inner circle, she was a respected pillar of the community, a beacon of hope for those seeking healing. Through sheer force of personality, she had positioned herself as the ultimate life coach, seemingly preying on LDS people who had started out simply wanting some coping tools, new ways to heal, and look at the world. Instead, they found themselves trapped in a rigid script and tyrannical system designed to strip them of their autonomy while Jody monetized their so-called healing. Ruby's descent into Jody's world hit warp speed when she took the 6-week life coach training course. Suddenly, she wasn't just drinking the Kool-Aid, she was brewing it. On Saturdays, I'd watch her hang on Jody's every Zoom broadcasted word like she was the second coming. The stars in my mom's eyes were blinding. Before long, Ruby had become a certified connections life coach, leading support calls in women's groups. Client confidentiality became a joke as she reported weekly to Jody. Big sister was here. One night at dinner, mom casually mentioned that a woman in her support group had been cheating. The offense? Noticing the mailman was attractive. In connections warped reality, this constituted infidelity. Jody's teachings were extreme. A married man talking to a female coworker could be unfaithful, and glimpsing attractive people online might be classified as porn addiction. Only absolute purity of thought was acceptable. In Jody's rigid world, innocence was rare. Those deemed distorted, usually husbands, were told to abandon their families to work on themselves, alone. Jody seemed to specialize in guiding wives to distance themselves from their husbands, or kicking them out entirely. Connections language framed it as inviting him to leave, code for, I'm going to make you isolate yourself from everyone you know except Jody. Shockingly, the husbands often went along with it, fully convinced that it was in the best interest of their families. It was like watching lemmings jump off a cliff. This self-imposed isolation was part of Jody's twisted rings of responsibility concept. If you were distorted, you'd be stripped of every responsibility except self-improvement. No job, no community, no family. Just you and Jody's teachings in a vacuum, solitary confinement. But you have to pay for the privilege, all in the name of healing. These separations typically lasted at least 6 months, the minimum time Jody deemed necessary to demonstrate genuine change. Her logic was that anyone could fake remorse or make short-term adjustments, but sustaining change for half a year proved sincere transformation. Adults were essentially put on probation in their relationships, expected to prove their worth to Jody to earn back the privilege of family closeness. The six-month rule also applied to kids, and any significant transgression could result in a half-year sentence of restricted privileges, increased scrutiny, and constant pressure to demonstrate change. It's interesting to compare Ruby's glacial approach to parenting with Jody's rigid philosophy. The two weren't just similar, they were symbiotic. Jody's connections doctrine wasn't so much a revelation to Ruby as it was a mirror, reflecting and magnifying the harsh worldview she'd always held. After all, Ruby had always doled out love like a miser with coins, making her affection contingent on a prolonged demonstration of good behavior. In her world, love wasn't a given. It was a prize to be earned through perfect conduct, a carrot dangled just out of reach to keep us constantly striving, constantly proving ourselves worthy. Connections wasn't introducing Ruby to a new way of thinking. It was giving her the vocabulary and pseudoscientific backing to justify what she'd been doing all along. Jody's system had simply slapped a fancy label on this emotional starvation diet and called it therapy. In the end, connections didn't change Ruby's tactics. It just gave her a manual to refine them. Ruby didn't announce Jody's arrival or her newfound interest in connections with any fanfare on Eight Passengers. Instead, the shift was subtle, a slow integration of new ideas and terminology into her existing content. It was as if she were testing the waters, gauging her audience's reaction to this new philosophy. I remember noticing the change in her language first. Suddenly, truth became a buzzword in her videos and blog posts. She'd casually mention how she'd found this self-help program that was revolutionizing her approach to parenting and life in general. It was presented as just another tool in her parenting arsenal, another piece of advice she was sharing with her followers. Ruby began promoting connections events to her audience, though she didn't immediately reveal the depth of her involvement. She'd mention upcoming conferences or encourage her followers to sign up for free Saturday classes. It was framed as an exciting opportunity for self-improvement, a chance for her audience to access the same wisdom that was supposedly transforming our family life. She positioned it as an evolution, a natural next step in her journey as a mother and influencer. Her followers, already primed to trust her advice, began to show interest in these new ideas, even though they couldn't see how connections was already starting to destroy our family. For instance, when Jody decided that Chad wasn't improving fast enough, she advised my parents to immediately pull him out of track and football, crushing all his teenage dreams. For Chad, track and football were his lifeline, his ticket to a brighter future. He had won first place in the district 100-meter dash, also in the 200-meter dash. Coaches whispered about his potential, and the dream of a football or track scholarship seemed within reach. It was more than just a way to pay for college. It was Chad's chance to prove himself, to carve out an identity beyond the constraints of our family's dysfunction. But with one nod from Ruby and Kevin, Jody's interference shattered all those dreams. How could Chad possibly commit to track and football when he couldn't even be fully responsible for himself? Nope, Chad would be barred from sports until he was fixed. And that meant taking away the one thing that gave him purpose and joy. I stood in the doorway of Chad's room, watching him methodically pack away his football gear. "Chad," I said softly, "do you really have to do this?" He looked up at me, his eyes hollow. "You know I do, Sherry. Mom and Dad made it clear." "Jody says..." "Who cares what Jody says?" I blurted out. Chad's lips quirked in a sad smile. "Yeah, well, try telling that to Mom and Dad." As if on cue, Ruby's voice floated up from downstairs. "Chad, Jody's on the phone. She wants to talk to you." I watched my brother's shoulders slump even further. He stood up, casting one last longing look at his gear before heading downstairs, like a condemned man walking to the gallows. This isn't right, I thought, my heart aching. In the world of competitive sports, especially at the high school level, timing is everything. You can't just pause your athletic career and expect to pick it up again years later without consequences. They effectively ruined his chances at the scholarships he had worked so hard for. All in the name of what? Even now, I struggle to understand their reasoning. I followed Chad down, hovering at the edge of the living room as he took the phone from Ruby. Her face was beaming, as if she were handing him a gift instead of a death sentence for his dreams. "Hello, Jody," Chad said, his voice flat. I couldn't hear Jody's words, but I could see their effect on my brother. With each passing moment, that light in his eyes dimmed a little more. "Yep, I get it," he mumbled. "I need to focus on being responsible for myself before I can be responsible to a team." I wanted to scream. "Don't you see what you're doing to him? Don't you understand what you're taking away?" In that moment, I saw flashes of a future crumbling away. Chad scoring the winning touchdown, scouts clamoring to offer him scholarships. A path out and away from all of this madness. All that, now gone. As Chad handed the phone back to Ruby, Kevin clapped him on the shoulder. "This is for the best, son. Jody knows what she's talking about." Chapter 18. Isolation Tactics. As I watched my family and so many others succumb to Jody's twisted dogma, I couldn't help but wonder, what on earth was the source of that woman's power? Why did this woman in her ugly khaki shorts and long-sleeved shirts have such a hold on people? Was it the promise of absolute truth? Her supreme self-confidence that offered some illusion of certainty in a world that seems to be unraveling at the seams? Or was it the way she enabled people's hatred of others and themselves? I noticed how Ruby was beginning to turn on her parents and siblings, confronting difficult memories of her past in ways she never dared before. Always the poster child for moving forward, she'd spent her life plastering over her childhood wounds with a veneer of perfection and daily phone calls to her mother. Her relationship with her mom bordered on codependency, a fact I'd always found unsettling given my own emotional distance from Ruby. But Jody's emphasis on ceaseless inventory and inner work cracked that carefully constructed facade. Suddenly, Ruby's wounded inner child emerged, raw and angry, recalling incidents that she'd long buried, sending shockwaves through the entire Griffiths clan. None of them had shown an interest in joining Connections despite Ruby's glowing reviews. Increasingly, though, Ruby felt that unless they embraced Connections, healing would never be possible. This severing didn't manifest overnight. It took around 2 or 3 years before Ruby would cut ties entirely with her family. And as I watched Ruby delete contact after contact from her phone, I couldn't help but wonder, was this healing? It was as if Jody had flipped a switch in Ruby's brain, turning familial love into contempt overnight. In the back of my mind, a terrifying thought took root. If Ruby could cut off the entire Griffiths family so easily, what would stop her from doing the same to us? Would I wake up one day and find myself deleted from the family iMessage thread? I wanted to support my mother, despite the complex emotions I harbored toward her. Perhaps it was because I could empathize with the experience of holding resentment against one's parents and grappling with unresolved childhood trauma. I instinctively understood that unaddressed pain often perpetuates cycles of hurt, passing from one generation to the next. I never thought about it before, that even those who present a flawless facade to the world, like my mother, might be struggling with deep-seated issues that remain hidden from view. How their polished exterior can serve as a mask, concealing the inner turmoil and unhealed wounds that continue to fester beneath the surface. Recognizing this for the first time, I did feel a sense of compassion for my mother, kinship even, acknowledging that her seemingly perfect demeanor and the darkness behind it might have had a lot to do with her own unresolved past. One evening, Ruby pulled me aside after dinner for a little talk. "Sherry, we're taking you out of track so you can focus on what's really important, your personal development," my mother said. I was stunned. Track, the only sport I actually enjoyed, was being taken away from me? What would be next, banning me from breathing? "But why?" I asked, desperately hoping this was just a really bad joke. "You're not emotionally vulnerable with me," Ruby said. "There's a wall between us. Imagine how it'll affect your husband in the future. You think any man wants to put up with that? A cold, shut-down wife?" "I don't understand." "Sherry, you don't have empathy. You're not compassionate. As your parent, it's my job to help you fix your flaws before it's too late. That's why your father and I have decided to give you the gift of one-on-one sessions with Jody. My stomach dropped. Over my dead body was I letting that woman anywhere near my brain. I'd rather lobotomize myself with a spoon. Chad is making so much progress with her, Ruby continued. Now it's your turn. I dug my nails into my palms, fighting the urge to scream. Instead, I just stayed silent, turned to stone. Maybe if I didn't move, they'd think I was a statue and leave me alone. Ruby's eyes flashed, sensing my anger. The choice is yours, Sherry. You either do one-on-one counseling with Jody, or we take away your car, your phone, and pull you out of school entirely. You decide. My jaw dropped. They couldn't be serious. But one look at my mom's face, and I knew she absolutely was. She would quite happily derail my entire life in my senior year of high school in order to force me into therapy with her totally sus life coach. Who were these pod people masquerading as my parents? I fled to my room, rage boiling beneath my skin. I opened up my laptop, my trembling fingers typing how to emancipate yourself from your parents into the search bar. But as the results loaded, reality crashed down. Where would I go? What would I do? Who would I be? The questions echoed in my mind, each one a painful reminder of my puppet status. At 17, I was a prisoner of circumstance. No friends outside our community, no support system, no escape route. I wish I could have walked out that door and never come back. But the cold truth was, I had nowhere to walk to. Chapter 19. Winning the Self-Loathing Olympics. The following week, I got on my first one-on-one phone call with Jody Hildebrandt. I took the call while sitting in the corner of my closet. I wanted to make sure no one could hear what was said. So, Sherry, Jody began, her tone matter-of-fact, let's dive right in. Our goal with these calls is to isolate and ultimately address the distorted thinking that is causing you to behave in a cold and entitled manner that is creating issues in the family. Can you tell me more about that from your perspective? I don't know, I said, already irritated. I really try to be a good person. But are you a good person? Yes, I think so. How do we even know for sure? Jody let the question hang in the air for a moment. Everyone has areas where they can grow, she said finally. Questioning yourself rigorously is a healthy start. It shows self-awareness. I agree with that, I said truthfully. Actually, I question myself all the time. It's kind of a problem. But are you asking yourself the right questions, Sherry? I don't think so. Otherwise, why would we be here? I listened as Jody explained how people engage in what she called logical fallacies, meaning the lies we tell ourselves. She said I might be lying to myself about being a good person, for instance, because it suited my distorted narrative. Then she explained how it's crucial, in order for us to get closer to the truth about ourselves, to identify every single way we are in distortion. In order to do that, we were going to embark on a new way of thinking, one involving radical self-honesty and rigorous personal inventory. Fine, I said. I'm open to taking inventory. I think our time's up, isn't it? Yes. Before we hang up, I'd like to address something, Sherry. I heard you had some disparaging things to say about me. Oh, crap. Blood rushed to my cheeks. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Don't be sorry. Be real. Fine, yes, I had some concerns. I said, be honest, Sherry. You were spreading gossip, lies, and rumors. Would you consider that to be compassionate behavior? Or do you prefer to blindly believe everything you see on the internet? I mean, if it's the truth, I started, feeling like I was walking into a verbal minefield. Oh, you're going to learn a lot about truth, Sherry. You'll love it. Chad does, and he seems much better now, isn't he? Jody said brightly, shifting gears. He seems more respectful, I said quietly. And your mother doesn't shout as much as she used to, does she? It was true. Ruby didn't raise her voice as much as she used to, since she'd been in connections. The question is, are you willing to do the same work to be a happier and more fulfilled person for your family and one day your spouse? Sure I am, I said, feeling like I'd just signed a deal with the devil. Or at least the devil's life coach. Chapter 20. Dirty Laundry. Weekly calls with Jody became a part of my routine, each session lasting about 50 minutes, a standard therapy hour, for which she charged my parents $175. Typically, our sessions were freeform conversations focused on analyzing my thoughts and experiences from the week before. She never, ever talked about herself. Even though she'd been very open about her history in her books, she always remained guarded in her personal interactions with me, never hinting at any past trauma. She didn't invite inquiries into her personal life, and I never felt comfortable asking her about herself directly. The relationship she was cultivating didn't leave room for such personal exchanges. It was all about quietly asserting domination while encouraging me to open up about my flaws and self-loathing, which I was happy to do. On our second call, Jody listened intently as I read from my list of distorted thinking episodes for that week. I was quite proud of my work, actually. Very thorough. Monday. Jumped to conclusions 3 times today. Thought in black and white about that hard test 7 times. Competed with Sarah and assumed I was better at math than she. Tuesday. Catastrophized about upcoming presentation 4 times. Overgeneralized my abilities based on 1 bad grade, 2 times. Personalized professor's general criticism of class performance, 3 times. Wednesday, engaged in should statements about my study habits, 5 times. Magnified importance of minor social faux pas at lunch, 2 times. Discounted positives and feedback on my essay draft, 3 times. And so on. Jody sighed when I finished, her voice heavy with disappointment. "Clearly, you have serious issues with adulation," she said. "I don't understand," I whispered, frustrated. "Adulation is when you think you're better than everybody else," Jody said. "Denigration is the opposite. Most people lean toward one or the other. It's clear to me you lean heavily towards adulating." "But I thought, if anything, I tend to self-denigrate." "But at your core, it's the opposite, Cherry." Jody informed me that for next week's homework, I'd have to write down every instance of self-adulation I indulged in, on top of all my other distorted thoughts. To my horror, there were quite a few. Yes, list number 2 was a real page-turner, bullet point after bullet point of damning evidence that I was, as Jody suspected, an insufferable smarty-pants, a teacher's pet, a grammar snob. Monday. Felt smug when I answered a question in class that no one else could. Silently congratulated myself for using whom correctly in a sentence. Thought I was better than others for reading a book above my grade level. Tuesday, felt superior for finishing the math test first. Privately judged classmates for their music tastes. Believed I was more mature than my peers for enjoying documentaries. Wednesday, felt proud of my extensive vocabulary during a presentation. Thought I was special for understanding a complex scientific concept quickly. Silently criticized others' grammar mistakes in group chat, and so on. I'd always been obsessed with microanalyzing myself, so in a twisted way, being forced to notice even more possible ways in which I was a terrible person was right up my alley. Before long, I was documenting and second-guessing every single word that came out of my mouth. Working with Jody was like a dream come true for my inner mean girl. We'd been training for the self-loathing Olympics for a while, but now it was finally showtime. And the best part? It was all framed as a healthy way of building self-awareness, a noble pursuit of personal growth and enlightenment. And so, each week, I continue to write, to document every flaw and failing, each moment of possible hubris, my pen a weapon turned inward. "Okay, this is much better, Cherry," Jody said 5 weeks in, her eyes scanning the pages of my meticulously documented mess-ups. "Now I'm going to teach you a very important technique, a way to transmute the adulation and turn it into something useful." "Okay," I said, my voice filled with an eagerness that was surprising even to my own ears. "Next time you identify your adulation, Cherry, I invite you to explore its opposite," Jody continued. "Think of it as a balancing exercise." "So I should self-denigrate instead?" "Very good, Cherry. So let's say you assume you're going to ace a test because, of course, you think you're so very clever. Change the language in your mind. Flip it. Think to yourself, 'Oh my gosh, I'm going to fail this test because I'm a very stupid little girl.'" "Excuse me?" "Yes, I want you to imagine what it feels like to fail that test. Really inhabit the feeling." "Ugh," I hesitated, my stomach churning. Failing a test? Was she kidding? I had never done that in my life. It was outside everything I knew. "Cherry, be humble. You are far less clever than you think you are. Now tell me how that feels." Be honest. I took a shaky breath and tried to imagine what it would feel like not understanding my favorite books. Confusion and frustration washed over me. This sucks, I whispered. Good. What else? How do you feel? I thought about trying to navigate the world and Ruby's mercurial moods without the anchor of my mind, my imagination. My ability to compartmentalize and cleverly pretend like everything was okay. It had gotten me out of trouble so many times. If I didn't have that guile, that wily understanding, I'd be like Chad, facing punishment and reprimands every 5 minutes. I feel scared, I said, my cheeks burning. Exposed. There it is, exclaimed Jody. You feel vulnerable. Vulnerability is what Sherry Frankie experiences when she realizes that she is not right about everything. And that, my dear, is what we call living in truth. As much as my gut tried to rebel against her methods, my mind couldn't refute her logic. By telling myself I was less than I thought I was, I found myself literally drowning in emotional vulnerability. And wasn't that the whole point of this therapy circus in the first place? To strip me down to my rawest, most vulnerable core so that my mom would finally approve of me? Jody's convoluted math seemed to add up. Self-deprecation plus vulnerability equals truth. And who was I to question her infallible calculations? I'm going to tell Ruby we had a real breakthrough today, said Jody afterward. I'm very proud of you, Sherry. Thank you, I said. And I'm so sorry for the things I said about you, Jody. I guess we shouldn't believe everything we see online. She chuckled. No, we shouldn't, she said, her voice dripping with the satisfaction of a predator who knows she has finally caught her prey. Chapter 21. Jody Says. Like Ruby, Kevin, and Chad, I drank the Connections Kool-Aid. More like chugged it by the gallon. Within a few months of starting my one-on-one therapy sessions with Jody, I was a card-carrying, insufferable Connections convert, obsessed with analyzing every thought that crossed my own mind, as well as every thought that crossed anyone else's mind, too. As you can imagine, I was a real joy to be around, and every interaction became an opportunity for me to showcase my newfound enlightenment. Oh, you think you did well on that test? That's just your adulation talking. Let's explore the opposite, shall we? How does it feel to imagine failing miserably? I could practically hear my friends' eyes rolling back into their heads as I launched into yet another lecture on the dangers of distorted thinking. But I couldn't help myself, couldn't resist the urge to correct their flawed perceptions, to show them the error of their ways. Not now that I understood truth. I managed to drive away most of my friends at school. Surprise, surprise, no one wanted to be around a preachy 17-year-old firebrand, a mini Jody obsessed with calling out their every cognitive distortion. But hey, they're lost, right? They just couldn't handle my superior grasp of the human psyche. Watching them drift away, along with their laughter and easy camaraderie, I sometimes wondered if the price of my enlightenment was worth it. Then I realized that losing all my friends was just part of the process. It was a test to see how strong and dedicated I was to truth, just like the widow had been dedicated to her faith. We must be willing to sacrifice for our beliefs, I told myself every time I alienated another friend. Anyway, unlike me, they're all going to hell. And so I soldiered on, my head held high, my mind brimming with Jody's teachings. I was a warrior, ready to take on the world, one distorted thought at a time. I didn't need anyone's validation. I had Jody's approval, which meant I had Ruby's, and that was all that mattered. One day, a good friend and I were sitting on the worn wooden benches outside school, the sun beating down on us, when she turned to me, her voice lowering to a conspiratorial whisper. Sherry, I kissed 3 boys over the weekend, and I was telling Sarah about it, and she basically called me a whore, she said guiltily. What do you think? I couldn't believe my friend since 9th grade was expecting me to sympathize. As a fellow member of the LDS Church, sworn to a vow of chastity before marriage, she was treading on thin ice. She is so damned, I thought. And what was your motive for kissing all those people? I asked icily. She looked at me like I had sprouted horns. Motive? They were cute? Why does there need to be some deep reason? Her voice was rising with each word, attracting curious glances from nearby students. I gave her my best Connections look, a perfect blend of condescension and pity, and placed a sympathetic hand on her shoulder, as if I were a wise sage bestowing my profound insights upon a lowly peasant. As your friend, I must ask, what does a kiss actually mean to you? What part of your ego was it serving when you chose to share yourself in that way? She shrugged me off, her eyes narrowing. Sherry, why are you interrogating me? I'm just curious. You're judging. You're being so mean. I thought you were my friend. Don't you remember when you were the one going around kissing boys? True growth comes from confronting our deepest flaws. Are you willing to do that work? Oh, get lost, Sherry. Who even are you anymore? Tears spilling down her cheeks, she got up and stormed off. A flicker of remorse stirred within me, a tiny voice whispering that maybe, just maybe, I had crossed a line. But that voice was quickly drowned out by the deafening roar of my own self-righteousness, my unwavering conviction that I, wise Sherry, was merely trying to guide the sweet, poor lamb out of distortion and toward truth. I guess she just isn't ready, I thought. She'll thank me later. She didn't. In fact, she never spoke to me again. Even teachers weren't safe from my sanctimony. In English class, I decided to take it upon myself to shred the book we were reading, The Chosen, by Chaim Potok, a poignant and well-written story about a friendship between two Jewish boys growing up in Brooklyn at the end of World War II. Personally, I felt ready for a more challenging text, something that would truly test my superior intellect. This feels a little babyish. I think we should be reading harder things, I announced to the teacher at the beginning of class. Behold, mortals, for Sherry has spoken. My teacher raised an eyebrow. I think you'll find it has a lot to offer, Sherry. It was nominated for some big awards. It's a very well-respected text, not a children's book by any means. His gentle rebuke pricked my conscience, and I wondered if maybe I was being a bit of a pretentious jerk. But what did he know? I was the one learning to dismantle distortion. Awards? Respect? Those were just societal constructs designed to keep us from truth. What is it, Sherry? Said the teacher, as if reading my disdainful thoughts. Go on, tell us what you think. I think you're engaging in emotional reasoning, letting your positive feelings about The Chosen cloud your judgment about its suitability for the class, I said. Just because you personally find it poignant and well-written does not mean it is the ideal choice from an objective educational standpoint. You're worshiping the should without rationally evaluating whether it truly meets students' needs, which means your thought process is distorted by unexamined assumptions and an overly adulatory view of the book's merits for this particular purpose. Boom. Mic drop. Sherry 1, teacher 0. He asked me if I was finished, which of course I wasn't. Finished? I'm just getting started. My classmates could not believe my preachiness, their faces a mixture of confusion and annoyance. I could feel their silent pleas for me to just shut the hell up and let them learn in peace. My teacher, fortunately, seemed to think it was all quite funny. Ever considered going into law, Sherry? He chuckled before telling us to turn to page 52. Actually, yes, I have, I muttered, flipping to the page, annoyed, my cheeks burning with a mixture of embarrassment and self-satisfaction. How strange, being someone who'd always felt so shy, but was now compelled to yell from the rooftops that she was the only one who truly understood the world. When I told Ruby about the incidents at school, she was thrilled. Wow, that was so truthful and loving of you to reflect that to your promiscuous friend, she said, pride in her eyes. So you don't think it was bad that I asked her what her motives were? No, that was a good question of you to ask, Sherry. And how did she respond? Well, she got kind of upset. Can you see how that's a reflection of her distortion? She wasn't comfortable with your questions, even though you were just reflecting truth. My sweet Sherry, you're so brave and clever. I wasn't brave or clever. I was just riding high on my wave of self-righteous connection zeal. That's what being in a cult like Connections feels like. Like you're special, and no one else understands the special knowledge that you have. It's addictive. My eyes were sharp and my tongue sharper as I sought out every imperfect, distortion-filled soul that crossed my path. In my eyes, I was a crusader for truth, a warrior for enlightenment, determined to expose the flaws and weaknesses of those around me. In other words, I was a mean, judgmental scold, but I couldn't see that. And I didn't care if I lost every friend I had, if it meant hearing praise fall from my mother's lips. I'm so proud of the woman you're becoming, she'd say, her words filling me up like a balloon. I drank in this new and hard-won approval like a flower turning toward the sun. My whole life, all I'd ever wanted was to be seen and truly appreciated by my mother. With Jody's teachings as my guide, it seemed as though now I was learning how to access all that love and acceptance I'd been craving for so long. Finally, Ruby liked me. Some days, it almost felt like we were friends. Chapter 22. Burn It and Be Damned. In 2019, thanks to the channel's continuing success, 2.5 million subscribers and climbing, Ruby and Kevin bought a new house in Springville, just a block away from the first 8 passengers' house and a far cry from our modest beginnings. This new house was a sprawling 3-story structure with an epic tree-filled backyard made for entertaining. Hello, hot tub. With 7 bedrooms and 6 bathrooms, well, 5 full and 1 half, it was more than spacious enough for our family and our adorable new Cavapoo puppy, Dwight, who we'd gotten after Nolly passed away. All the girls had bedrooms upstairs, sharing the top floor. Ruby and Kevin's master suite occupied the main floor, a buffer zone between the gender-divided levels. The boys, Chad and my youngest brother, had claimed the basement as their domain, complete with their own bathroom, a pool table, and a foosball table, and even a full kitchen, although Ruby quickly commandeered it for extra freeze-drying storage. Ruby's 2 large freeze dryers ran ceaselessly, humming away 24 hours a day, preserving everything from leftovers to bulk-bought sale items. Nothing was safe from their grasp. Leftover steak, vegetables on sale at the store,